spark. It lit up like a match. With my mini-torch in hand, I started a slow hydrazine flow. It sizzled on the iridium and disappeared. Soon I had short bursts of flame sputtering from the chimney. The main thing I had to watch was the temperature. Hydrazine breaking down is extremely exothermic, so I did it a bit at a time, constantly watching the readout of a thermocouple I'd attached to the iridium chamber. Point is, the process worked. Each hydrazine tank holds a little over 50 liters, which would be enough to make 100 liters of water. I'm limited by my oxygen production, but I'm all excited now, so I'm willing to use half my reserves. Long story short, I'll stop when the tank is half empty, and I'll have 50 liters of water at the end. Log entry. Sol 34. Well, that took a really long time. I've been at it all night with the hydrazine, but I got the job done. I could have finished faster, but I figured caution's best when setting fire to rocket fuel in an enclosed space. Boy, is this place a tropical jungle now, I'll tell you. It's almost 30 degrees Celsius in here, and humid as all hell. I just dumped a ton of heat and 50 liters of water into the air. During this process, the poor hab had to be the mother of a messy toddler. It's been replacing the oxygen I've used, and the water reclaimer's trying to get the humidity down to sane levels. Nothing to be done about the heat. There's actually no air conditioning in the hab. Mars is cold. Getting rid of excess heat isn't something we expected to deal with. I've now grown accustomed to hearing the alarms blare at all times. The fire alarm is finally stopped, now that there's no more fire. The low oxygen alarm should stop soon. The high humidity alarm will take a little longer. The water reclaimer has its work cut out for it today. For a moment, there was yet another alarm. The water reclaimer's main tank was full. Booyah! That's the kind of problem I want to have. Remember the spacesuit I vandalized yesterday? I hung it on its rack and carried buckets of water to it from the reclaimer. It can hold an atmosphere of air in. It should be able to handle a few buckets of water. Man, I'm tired. Been up all night, and it's time to sleep. But I'll drift off to dreamland in the best mood I've been in since Sol 6. Things are finally going my way. In fact, they're going great. I have a chance to live after all. Log entry. Sol 37. I am fucked and I'm gonna die. Okay, calm down. I'm sure I can get around this. I'm writing this log to you, dear future Mars archaeologist from Rover 2. You may wonder why I'm not in the hab right now. Because I fled in terror, that's why. And I'm not sure what the hell to do next. I guess I should explain what happened. If this is my last entry, you'll at least know why. Over the past few days, I've been happily making water. It's been going swimmingly. See what I did there? Swimmingly. I even beefed up the MAV fuel plant compressor. It was very technical. I increased the voltage to the pump. So I'm making water even faster now. After my initial burst of 50 liters, I decided to settle down and just make it at the rate I get O2. I'm not willing to go below a 25-liter reserve, so when I dip too low, I stop dicking with hydrazine until I get the O2 back up to well above 25 liters. Important note. When I say I made 50 liters of water, that's an assumption. I didn't reclaim 50 liters of water. The additional soil I'd filled the hab with was extremely dry and greedily sucked up a lot of the humidity. That's where I want the water to go anyway, so I'm not worried, and I wasn't surprised when the reclaimer didn't get anywhere near 50 liters. I get 10 liters of CO2 every 15 hours now that I souped up the pump. I've done this process 4 times. My math tells me that, including my initial 50-liter burst, I should have added 130 liters of water to the system. Well, my math was a damn liar. I'd gained 70 liters in the water reclaimer and the spacesuit-turned-water tank. There's plenty of condensation on the walls and domed roof, and the soil is certainly absorbing its fair share, but that doesn't account for 60 liters of missing water. Something was wrong. That's when I noticed the other O2 tank. The hab has 2 reserve O2 tanks, one on each side of the structure for safety reasons. The hab can decide which one to use whenever it wants. Turns out, it's been topping off the atmosphere from tank 1. But when I add O2 to the system, via the oxygenator, the hab evenly distributes the gain between the 2 tanks. Tank 2 has been slowly gaining oxygen. That's not a problem. The hab is just doing its job. But it does mean I've been gaining O2 over time, which means I'm not consuming it as fast as I thought. At first, I thought, yay, more oxygen. Now I can make water faster. But then a more disturbing thought occurred to me. Follow my logic. I'm gaining O2, but the amount I'm bringing in from outside is constant, so the only way to gain it is to be using less than I thought. But I've been doing the hydrazine reaction with the assumption that I was using all of it. The only possible explanation is that I haven't been burning all the released hydrogen. It's obvious now in retrospect, but it never occurred to me that some of the hydrogen just wouldn't burn. It got past the flame and went on its merry way. Damn it, Jim, I'm a botanist, not a chemist. Chemistry is messy, so there's unburned hydrogen in the air, all around me, mixed in with the oxygen, just hanging out, waiting for a spark so it can blow the hab up. Once I figured this out and composed myself, I got a Ziploc-sized sample bag and waved it around a bit, then sealed it. Then, a quick EVA to a rover where we keep the atmospheric analyzers. Nitrogen, 22%. Oxygen, 9%. Hydrogen, 64%. I've been hiding here in the rover ever since. It's Hydrogenville in the hab. I'm very lucky it hasn't blown. Even a small static discharge would have led to my own private Hindenburg. So I'm here in Rover 2. I can stay for a day or two tops before the CO2 filters from the rover and my spacesuit fill up. I have that long to figure out how to deal with this. The hab is now a bomb. Chapter 5. Log Entry. Sol 38. I'm still cowering in the rover, but I've had time to think, and I know how to deal with the hydrogen. I thought about the atmospheric regulator. It pays attention to what's in the air and balances it. That's how the excess O2 I've been importing ends up in the tanks. Problem is, it's just not built to pull hydrogen out of the air. The regulator uses freeze separation to sort out the gases. When it decides there's too much oxygen, it starts collecting air in a tank and cooling it to 90 Kelvin. That makes the oxygen turn to liquid, but leaves the nitrogen, condensation point 77 Kelvin, still gaseous. Then it stores the O2. But I can't get it to do that for hydrogen because hydrogen needs to be below 21 Kelvin to turn liquid, and the regulator just can't get temperatures that low. Dead end. Here's the solution. Hydrogen is dangerous because it can blow up, but it can only blow up if there's oxygen around. Hydrogen without oxygen is harmless, and the regulator is all about pulling oxygen out of the air. There are four different safety interlocks that prevent the regulator from letting the hab's oxygen content get too low.
But they're designed to work against technical faults, not deliberate sabotage. Bwah-ha-ha!
Long story short, I can trick the regulator into pulling all the oxygen out of the hab. Then I can wear a spacesuit so I can breathe and do whatever I want without fear of blowing up. I'll use an O2 tank to spray short bursts of oxygen at the hydrogen and make a spark with a couple of wires and a battery. It'll set the hydrogen on fire, but only until the small bit of oxygen is used up. I'll just do that over and over in controlled bursts until I've burned off all the hydrogen. One tiny flaw with that plan. It'll kill my dirt. The dirt is only viable soil because of the bacteria growing in it. If I get rid of all the oxygen, the bacteria will die. I don't have 100 billion little spacesuits handy. It's half a solution anyway. Time to take a break from thinking. Commander Lewis was the last one to use this rover. She was scheduled to use it again on Sol 7, but she went home instead. Her personal travel kit's still in the back. Rifling through it, I found a protein bar and a personal USB, probably full of music to listen to on the drive. Time to chow down and see what the good commander brought along for music. Log Entry, Sol 38, 2. Disco. God damn it, Lewis. Log Entry, Sol 39. I think I've got it. Soil bacteria are used to winters. They get less active and require less oxygen to survive. I can lower the hab temperature to 1 degree Celsius, and they'll nearly hibernate. This sort of thing happens on Earth all the time. They can survive a couple of days this way. If you're wondering how bacteria on Earth survive longer periods of cold, the answer is they don't. Bacteria from further underground, where it is warmer, breed upward to replace the dead ones. They'll still need some oxygen, but not much. I think a 1% content will do the trick. That leaves a little in the air for the bacteria to breathe, but not enough to maintain a fire, so the hydrogen won't blow up. But that leads to yet another problem. The potato plants won't like the plan. They don't mind the lack of oxygen, but the cold will kill them. So I'll have to pot them, bag them, actually, and move them to a rover. They haven't even sprouted yet, so it's not like they need light. It was surprisingly annoying to find a way to make the heat stay on when the rover's unoccupied, but I figured it out. After all, I've got nothing but time in here. So that's the plan. First, bag the potato plants and bring them to the rover. Make sure it keeps the damn heater on. Then drop the hab temperature to 1 degree Celsius, then reduce the O2 content to 1%, then burn off the hydrogen with a battery, some wires, and a tank of O2. Yeah, this all sounds like a great idea with no chance of catastrophic failure. That was sarcasm, by the way. Well, off I go. Log entry. Sol 40. Things weren't 100% successful. They say no plan survives first contact with implementation. I'd have to agree. Here's what happened. I summoned up the courage to return to the hab. Once I got there, I felt a little more confident. Everything was how I'd left it. What did I expect, Martians looting my stuff? It would take a while to let the hab cool, so I started that right away by turning the temperature down to 1 degree Celsius. I bagged the potato plants and got a chance to check up on them while I was at it. They're rooting nicely and about to sprout. One thing I hadn't accounted for was how to bring them from the hab to the rovers. The answer was pretty easy. I put all of them in Martinez's spacesuit. Then I dragged it out with me to the rover I'd set up as a temporary nursery. Making sure to jimmy the heater to stay on, I headed back to the hab. By the time I got back, it was already chilly, down to 5 degrees Celsius already. Shivering and watching my breath condense in front of me, I threw on extra layers of clothes. Fortunately, I'm not a very big man. Martinez's clothes fit over mine, and Vogel's fit over Martinez's. These shitty clothes were designed to be worn in a temperature-controlled environment. Even with 3 layers, I was still cold. I climbed into my bunk and under the covers for more warmth. Once the temperature got to 1 degree Celsius, I waited another hour just to make sure the bacteria and the dirt got the memo that it was time to take it slow. The next problem I ran into was the regulator. Despite my swaggering confidence, I wasn't able to outwit it. It really does not want to pull too much O2 out of the air. The lowest I could get it to was 15%. After that, it flatly refused to go lower, and nothing I did mattered. I had all these plans about getting in and reprogramming it, but the safety protocols turned out to be in ROMs. I can't blame it. Its whole purpose is to prevent the atmosphere from becoming lethal. Nobody at NASA thought, hey, let's allow a fatal lack of oxygen that will make everyone drop dead. So I had to use a more primitive plan. The regulator uses a different set of vents for air sampling than it does for main air separation. The air that gets free separated comes in through a single large vent on the main unit, but it samples the air from 9 small vents that pipe back to the main unit. That way it gets a good average of the hab, and one localized imbalance won't throw it off. I taped up 8 of the intakes, leaving only 1 of them active. Then I taped the mouth of a hefty-sized bag over the neck hole of a spacesuit, Johansson's this time. In the back of the bag, I poked a small hole and taped it over the remaining intake. Then I inflated the bag with pure O2 from the suit's tanks. Holy shit, the regulator thought. I better pull O2 out right away. Worked great. I decided not to wear a spacesuit after all. The atmospheric pressure was going to be fine. All I needed was oxygen, so I grabbed an O2 canister and breather mask from the medical bay. That way, I had a hell of a lot more freedom of motion. It even had a rubber band to keep it on my face. Though I did need a spacesuit to monitor the actual hab oxygen level now that the hab's main computer was convinced it was 100% O2. Let's see. Martinez's spacesuit was in the rover. Johansson's was outwitting the regulator. Lewis's was serving as a water tank. I didn't want to mess with mine. Hey, it's custom fitted. That left me 2 spacesuits to work with. I grabbed Vogel's suit and activated the internal air sensors while leaving the helmet off. Once the oxygen dropped to 12%, I put the breather mask on. I watched it fall further and further. When it reached 1%, I cut power to the regulator. I may not be able to reprogram the regulator, but I can turn the bastard off completely. The hab has emergency flashlights in many locations in case of critical power failure. I tore the LED bulbs out of one and left the two frayed power wires very close together. Now, when I turned it on, I got a small spark. Taking a canister of O2 from Vogel's suit, I attached a strap to both ends and slung it over my shoulder. Then I attached an airline to the tank and crimped it with my thumb. I turned on a very slow trickle of O2, small enough that it couldn't overpower the crimp. Standing on the table with a sparker in one hand and my oxygen line in the other, I reached up and gave it a try. And holy hell, it worked. Blowing the O2 over the sparker, I flicked the switch on the flashlight and a wonderful jet of flame fired out of the tube. The fire alarm went off, of course, but I'd heard it so much lately I barely noticed it anymore. Then I did it again, and again, short bursts, nothing flashy. I was happy to take my time. I was elated. This was the best plan ever. Not only was I clearing out the hydrogen, I was making more water. Everything went great, right up to the explosion. 1 minute I was happily burning hydrogen, the next I was on the other side of the hab, and a lot of stuff was knocked over. I stumbled to my feet and saw the hab in disarray. My first thought was, my ears hurt like hell. Then I thought, I'm dizzy, and fell to my knees. Then I fell prone. I was that dizzy. I groped my head with both hands, looking for a head wound I desperately hoped would not be there. Nothing seemed to be amiss. But feeling all over my head and face revealed the true problem. My oxygen mask had been ripped off in the blast. I was breathing nearly pure nitrogen. The floor was covered in junk from all over the hab. No hope of finding the medical O2 tank. No hope of finding anything in this mess before I passed out. Then I saw Lewis's suit hanging right where it belonged. It hadn't moved in the blast. It was heavy to start with and had 70 liters of water in it. I rushed over, quickly cranked on the O2, and stuck my head into the neck hole. I'd removed the helmet long ago for easy access to the water. I breathed a bit until the dizziness faded, then took a deep breath and held it. Still holding my breath, I glanced over to the spacesuit and hefty bag I'd used to outsmart the regulator. The bad news is I'd never removed them. The good news is the explosion removed them. 8 of the 9 intakes for the regulator were still bagged, but this one would at least tell the truth. Stumbling over to the regulator, I turned it back on. After a 2-second boot process, it was made to start up fast for obvious reasons, it immediately identified the problem. The shrill, low-oxygen alarm blared throughout the hab as the regulator dumped pure oxygen into the atmosphere as fast as it safely could. Separating oxygen from the atmosphere is difficult and time-consuming, but adding it is as simple as opening a valve. I clambered over debris back to Lewis's spacesuit and put my head back in for more good air. Within 3 minutes, the regulator had brought the hab oxygen back up to par. I noticed for the first time how burned my clothing was. It was a good time to be wearing 3 layers of clothes. Mostly the damage was on my sleeves. The outer layer was gone. The middle layer was singed and burned clean through in places. The inner layer, my own uniform, was in reasonably good shape. Looks like I lucked out again. Also, glancing at the hab's main computer, I saw the temperature had gone up to 15 degrees Celsius. Something very hot and very explodey had happened, and I wasn't sure what or how. And that's where I am now, wondering what the hell happened. After all that work and getting blown up, I'm exhausted. Tomorrow I'll have to do a million equipment checks and try to figure out what exploded, but for now I just want to sleep. I'm in the rover again tonight. Even with the hydrogen gone, I'm reluctant to hang out in a hab that has a history of exploding for no reason. Plus, I can't be sure there isn't a leak. This time I brought a proper meal and something to listen to that isn't disco. Log entry. Sol 41. I spent the day running full diagnostics on every system in the hab. It was incredibly boring, but my survival depends on these machines, so it had to be done. I can't just assume an explosion did no long-term damage. I did the most critical tests first. 1 was the integrity of the hab canvas. I felt pretty confident it was in good shape, because I'd spent a few hours asleep in the rover before returning to the hab, and the pressure was still good. The computer reported no change in pressure over that time, other than a minor fluctuation based on temperature. Then I checked the oxygenator. If that stops working and I can't fix it, I'm a dead man. No problems. Then the atmospheric regulator. Again, no problem. Heating unit, primary battery array, O2 and N2 storage tanks, water reclaimer, all three airlocks, lighting systems, main computer. On and on I went, feeling better and better as each system proved to be in perfect working order. Gotta hand it to NASA. They don't screw around when making this stuff. Then came the critical part, checking the dirt. I took a few samples from all over the hab. Remember, it's all dirt flooring now, and made slides. With shaking hands, I put a slide into the microscope and brought the image up on screen. There they were, healthy, active bacteria doing their thing. Looks like I won't be starving to death on Sol 400 after all. I plopped down in a chair and let my breathing return to normal. Then I set about cleaning up the mess, and I had a lot of time to think about what had happened. So what happened? Well, I have a theory. According to the main computer, during the blast, the internal pressure spiked to 1.4 atmospheres, and the temperature rose to 15 degrees Celsius in under a second. But the pressure quickly subsided back to 1 atmosphere. This would make sense if the atmospheric regulator were on, but I'd cut power to it. The temperature remained at 15 degrees Celsius for some time afterward, so any heat expansion should still have been present, but the pressure dropped down again. So where did that extra pressure go? Raising the temperature and keeping the same number of atoms inside should permanently raise the pressure, but it didn't. I quickly realized the answer. The hydrogen, the only available thing to burn, combined with oxygen, hence combustion, and became water. Water is 1,000 times as dense as a gas, so the heat added to the pressure, and the transformation of hydrogen and oxygen into water brought it back down again. The million-dollar question is, where the hell did the oxygen come from? The whole plan was to limit oxygen and keep an explosion from happening, and it was working for quite a while before blowing up. I think I have my answer, and it comes down to me brain farting. Remember when I decided not to wear a spacesuit? That decision almost killed me. The medical O2 tank mixes pure oxygen with surrounding air, then feeds it to you through a mask. The mask stays on your face with a little rubber band that goes around the back of your neck, not an airtight seal. I know what you're thinking. The mask leaked oxygen. But no. I was breathing the oxygen. When I was inhaling, I made a nearly airtight seal with the mask by sucking it to my face. The problem was exhaling. Do you know how much oxygen you absorb out of the air when you take a normal breath? I don't either, but it's not 100%. Every time I exhaled, I added more oxygen to the system. It just didn't occur to me, but it should have. If your lungs grabbed up all the oxygen, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation wouldn't work. I'm such a dumbass for not thinking of it, and my dumbassery almost got me killed. I'm really going to have to be more careful. It's a good thing I burned off most of the hydrogen before the explosion, otherwise that would have been the end. As it is, the explosion wasn't strong enough to pop the hab, though it was strong enough to almost blast my eardrums in. This all started with me noticing a 60-liter shortfall in water production. Between deliberate burn-off and a bit of unexpected explosion, I'm back on track. The water reclaimer did its job last night and pulled 50 liters of the newly created water out of the air. It's storing it in Lewis's spacesuit, which I'll call the cistern from now on because it sounds cooler. The other 10 liters of water was directly absorbed by the dry soil. Lots of physical labor today. I've earned a full meal. And to celebrate my first night back in the hab, I'll kick back and watch some shitty 20th century TV courtesy of Commander Lewis. The Dukes of Hazzard, eh? Let's give it a whirl. Log entry. Sol 42. I slept in late today. I deserved it. After 4 nights of awful sleep in the rover, my bunk felt like the softest, most profoundly beautiful feather bed ever made. Eventually, I dragged my ass out of bed and finished some post-explosion cleanup. I moved the potato plants back in today, and just in time, too. They're sprouting. They look healthy and happy. This isn't chemistry, medicine, bacteriology, nutrition analysis, explosion dynamics, or any other shit I've been doing lately. This is botany. I'm sure I can at least grow some plants without screwing up. Right? You know what really sucks? I've only made 130 liters of water. I have another 470 liters to go. You'd think after almost killing myself twice, I'd be able to stop screwing around with hydrazine. But nope. I'll be reducing hydrazine and burning hydrogen in the hab every 10 hours for another 10 days.
I'll do a better job of it from now on. Instead of counting on a clean reaction, I'll do frequent hydrogen cleanings with a small flame. It'll burn off gradually instead of building up to kill mark levels. I'll have a lot of dead time. 10 hours for each tank of CO2 to finish filling. It only takes 20 minutes to reduce the hydrazine and burn the hydrogen. I'll spend the rest of the time watching TV. And seriously, it's clear that General Lee can outrun a police cruiser. Why doesn't Roscoe just go to the Duke farm and arrest them when they're not in the car? Chapter 6. Venkat Kapoor returned to his office, dropped his briefcase on the floor, and collapsed into his leather chair. He took a moment to look out the windows. His office in Building 1 afforded him a commanding view of the large park in the center of the Johnson Space Center complex. Beyond that, dozens of scattered buildings dominated the view all the way to Mud Lake in the distance. Glancing at his computer screen, he noted 47 unread emails urgently demanding his attention. They could wait. Today had been a sad day. Today was the memorial service for Mark Watney. The president had given a speech praising Watney's bravery and sacrifice and the quick actions of Commander Lewis in getting everyone else to safety. Commander Lewis and the surviving crew via long-range communication from Hermes gave eulogies for their departed comrade from deep space. They had another 10 months of travel yet to endure. The administrator had given a speech as well, reminding everyone that spaceflight is incredibly dangerous and that we will not back down in the face of adversity. They'd asked Venkat if he was willing to make a speech. He declined. What was the point? Watney was dead. Nice words from the director of Mars operations wouldn't bring him back. "You okay, Venk?" came a familiar voice from the doorway. Venkat swiveled around. "Guess so," he said. Teddy Sanders swept a rogue thread off his otherwise immaculate blazer. "You could have given a speech."
"I didn't want to. You know that."
"Yeah, I know. I didn't want to either, but I'm the administrator of NASA. It's kind of expected. You sure you're okay?"
"Yeah, I'll be fine."
"Good," Teddy said, adjusting his cufflinks. "Let's get back to work, then."
"Sure," Venkat shrugged. "Let's start with you authorizing my satellite time."
Teddy leaned against the wall with a sigh.
"This again."
"Yes," Venkat said. "This again. What is the problem?"
"Okay, run me through it. What exactly are you after?"
Venkat leaned forward.
"Ares 3 was a failure, but we can salvage something from it. We're funded for 5 Ares missions. I think we can get Congress to fund a 6th.
"I don't know, Venk."
"It's simple, Teddy," Venkat pressed on. "The evac after 6 sols. There's almost an entire mission's worth of supplies up there. It would only cost a fraction of a normal mission. It normally takes 14 pre-supply probes to prep a site. We might be able to send what's missing in 3, maybe 2.
"Venk, the site got hit by a 175 kilometers per hour sandstorm. It'll be in really bad shape."
"That's why I want imagery," Venkat said. "I just need a couple of shots of the site. We could learn a lot."
"Like what? You think we'd send people to Mars without being sure everything was in perfect working order?"
"Everything doesn't have to be perfect," Venkat said quickly. "Whatever's broken, we'd send replacements for."
"How will we know from imagery what's broken?"
"It's just a first step. They evac'd because the wind was a threat to the MAV, but the HAB can withstand a lot more punishment. It might still be in one piece, and it'll be really obvious. If it popped, it'd completely blow out and collapse. If it's still standing, then everything inside will be fine. And the rovers are solid. They can take any sandstorm Mars has to offer. Just let me take a look, Teddy. That's all I want."
Teddy paced to the windows and stared out at the vast expanse of buildings.
"You're not the only guy who wants satellite time, you know. We have Ares 4 supply missions coming up. We need to concentrate on Schiaparelli Crater."
"I don't get it, Teddy. What's the problem here?" Venkat asked. "I'm talking about securing us another mission. We have 12 satellites in orbit around Mars. I'm sure you can spare one or two for a couple of hours." I can give you the windows for each one when they'll be at the right angle for Ares 3 shots.
It's not about satellite time, Venk, Teddy interrupted.
Venkit froze.
Then, but, what?
Teddy turned to face him.
We're a public domain organization. There's no such thing as secret or secure information here.
So?
Any imagery we take goes directly to the public.
Again, so?
Mark Watney's body will be within 20 meters of the HAB, maybe partially buried in sand, but still very visible, and with a comm antenna sticking out of his chest. Any images we take will show that.
Venkit stared, then glared.
This is why you denied my imagery requests for 2 months?
Venk, come on.
Really, Teddy, he said. You're afraid of a PR problem?
The media's obsession with Watney's death is finally starting to taper off, Teddy said evenly. It's been bad press after bad press for 2 months. Today's memorial gives people closure, and the media can move on to some other story. The last thing we want is to dredge everything back up.
So what do we do then? He's not going to decompose. He'll be there forever.
Not forever, Teddy said. Within a year, he'll be covered in sand from normal weather activity.
A year? Venkit said, rising to his feet. That's ludicrous. We can't wait a year for this.
Why not? Ares 4 won't even launch for another 5 years. Plenty of time.
Venkit took a deep breath and thought for a moment.
Okay, consider this. Sympathy for Watney's family is really high. Ares 6 could bring the body back. We don't say that's the purpose of the mission, but we make it clear that would be part of it. If we framed it that way, we'd get more support in Congress. But not if we wait a year. In a year, people won't care anymore.
Teddy rubbed his chin. Mindy Park stared at the ceiling. She had little else to do. The 3 a.m. shift was pretty dull. Only a constant stream of coffee kept her awake. Monitoring the status of satellites around Mars had sounded like an exciting proposition when she took the transfer, but the satellites tended to take care of themselves. Her job turned out to be sending emails as imagery became available.
"Master's degree in mechanical engineering," she muttered. "And I'm working in an all-night photo booth."
She sipped her coffee. A flicker on her screen announced that another set of images was ready for dispatch. She checked the name on the work order. Venkit Kapoor. She posted the data directly to internal servers and composed an email to Dr. Kapoor. As she entered the latitude and longitude of the image, she recognized the numbers.
31.2 degrees north, 28.5 degrees west. Acidalia Planitia?
Ares 3? Out of curiosity, she brought up the first of the 17 images. As she'd suspected, it was the Ares 3 site. She'd heard they were going to image it. Slightly ashamed of herself, she scoured the image for any sign of Mark Watney's dead body. After a minute of fruitless searching, she was simultaneously relieved and disappointed. She moved on to perusing the rest of the image. The HAB was intact. Dr. Kapoor would be happy to see that. She brought the coffee mug to her lips, then froze. She mumbled to herself. She brought up the NASA intranet and navigated through the site to the specifics of the Ares missions. After some quick research, she picked up her phone.
"Hey, this is Mindy Park at SATCON. I need the mission logs for Ares 3. Where can I get them?" Okay. Thanks.
After some more time on the intranet, she leaned back in her seat. She no longer needed the coffee to keep awake. Picking up the phone again, she said,
"Hello, security? This is Mindy Park in SATCON. I need the emergency contact number for Dr. Venkit Kapoor."
"Yes, it's an emergency."
Mindy fidgeted in her seat as Venkit trudged in. To have the director of Mars operations visiting SATCON was unusual. Seeing him in jeans and a t-shirt was even more unusual.
"You Mindy Park?"
he asked with the scowl of a man operating on 2 hours of sleep.
"Yes," she quavered. "Sorry to drag you in."
"I'm assuming you had a good reason.
So?
She said, looking down. It's... Well, the imagery you ordered. Come here and look. He pulled another chair to her station and seated himself.
Is this about Watney's body? Is that why you're shook up?
No, she said. She winced at her own awkwardness and pointed to the screen. Venkat inspected the image.
Looks like the Habs in one piece. That's good news. Solar array looks good. The rovers are okay, too. Main dish isn't around. No surprise there. What's the big emergency?
She said, touching her finger to the screen. That. Venkat leaned in and looked closer. Just below the Hab, beside the rovers, two white circles sat in the sand.
Looks like Hab canvas. Maybe the Hab didn't do well after all. I guess pieces got torn off and...
she interrupted. They look like rover pop tents.
Venkat looked again.
Probably right.
How'd they get set up? Mindy asked.
Venkat shrugged.
Commander Lewis probably ordered them deployed during the evac. Not a bad idea. Have the emergency shelters ready in case the MAV didn't work and the Hab breached.
Yeah, Mindy said, opening a document on her computer. This is the entire mission log for Sols 1 through 6, from MDV touchdown to MAV emergency liftoff.
Okay, and?
I read through it. Several times. They never threw out the pop tents.
Her voice cracked at the last word.
Well, Venkat said, furrowing his brow. They obviously did, but it didn't make it into the log.
They activated two emergency pop tents and never told anyone?
That doesn't make a lot of sense, no. Maybe the storm messed with the rovers and the tents auto-deployed.
So after auto-deploying, they detached themselves from the rovers and lined up next to each other 20 meters away?
Venkat looked back to the image.
Well, obviously, they activated somehow.
Why are the solar cells clean? Mindy said, fighting back tears. There was a huge sandstorm. Why isn't there sand all over them?
A good wind could have done it, Venkat said, unsure.
Did I mention I never found Watney's body? She said, sniffling.
Venkat's eyes widened as he stared at the picture.
Oh, he said quietly. Oh, God.
Mindy put her hands over her face and sobbed quietly.
Fuck, Annie Montrose said. You have got to be fucking kidding me.
Teddy glared across his immaculate mahogany desk at his director of media relations.
Not helping, Annie.
He turned to his director of Mars operations.
How sure are we of this?
100%, Venkat said.
Fuck, Annie said.
Teddy moved a folder on his desk slightly to the right so it would line up with his mouse pad.
It is what it is. We have to deal with it.
Do you have any idea the magnitude of shitstorm this is going to be? She retorted. You don't have to face those damn reporters every day. I do.
One thing at a time, Teddy said. Venk, what makes you sure he's alive?
For starters, no body, Venkat explained. Also, the pop tents are set up, and the solar cells are clean. You can thank Mindy Park and Satcon for noticing all that, by the way. But...
Venkat continued.
His body could have been buried in the Sol 6 storm. The pop tents might have auto-deployed, and wind could have blown them around. A 30 kilometers per hour windstorm sometime later would have been strong enough to clean the solar cells, but not strong enough to carry sand. It's not likely, but it's possible. So I spent the last few hours checking everything I could. Commander Lewis had two outings in Rover 2. The second was on Sol 5. According to the logs, after returning, she plugged it into the Hab for recharging. It wasn't used again, and 13 hours later, they evac'd.
He slid a picture across the desk to Teddy.
That's one of the images from last night. As you can see, Rover 2 is facing away from the Hab. The charging port is in the nose, and the cable isn't long enough to reach.
Teddy absently rotated the picture to be parallel with the edges of his desk.
"She must have parked it facing the hab, or she wouldn't have been able to plug it in," he said. "It's been moved since Sol 5.
"Yeah," Venkat said, sliding another picture to Teddy. "But here's the real evidence. In the lower right of the image you can see the MDV. It's been taken apart. I'm pretty sure they wouldn't have done that without telling us. And the clincher is on the right of the image," Venkat pointed. "The landing struts of the MAV. Looks like the fuel plant has been completely removed, with considerable damage to the struts in the process. There's just no way that could have happened before liftoff. It would have endangered the MAV way too much for Lewis to allow it."
"Hey," Annie said, "why not talk to Lewis? Let's go to Capcom and ask her directly."
Rather than answer, Venkat looked to Teddy knowingly.
"Because," Teddy said, "if Watney really is alive, we don't want the Ares III crew to know."
"What?" Annie said. "How can you not tell them?"
"They have another 10 months on their trip home," Teddy explained. "Space travel is dangerous. They need to be alert and undistracted. They're sad that they lost a crewmate, but they'd be devastated if they found out they'd abandoned him alive."
Annie looked to Venkat. "You're on board with this?"
"It's a no-brainer," Venkat said. "Let them deal with that emotional trauma when they're not flying a spaceship around."
"This'll be the most talked-about event since Apollo 11, Annie said. "How will you keep it from them?"
Teddy shrugged.
"Easy. We control all communication with them."
"Fuck," Annie said, opening her laptop. "When do you want to go public?"
"What's your take?" he asked.
Annie said. "We can hold the pics for 24 hours before we're required to release them. We'll need to send out a statement along with them. We don't want people working it out on their own. We'd look like assholes."
"Okay," Teddy agreed. "Put together a statement."
"That'll be fun," she grumbled.
"Where do we go from here?" Teddy asked Venkat.
"Step one is communication," Venkat said. "From the pics, it's clear the comm array is ruined. We need another way to talk. Once we can talk, we can assess and make plans."
"All right," Teddy said. "Get on it. Take anyone you want from any department. Use as much overtime as you want. Find a way to talk to him. That's your only job right now."
"Got it."
"Annie, make sure nobody gets wind of this till we announce."
"Right," Annie said. "Who else knows?"
"Just the three of us and Mindy Park and Satcon," Venkat said.
"I'll have a word with her," Annie said. Teddy stood and opened his cell phone.
"I'm going to Chicago. I'll be back tomorrow."
"Why?" Annie asked.
"That's where Watney's parents live," Teddy said. "I owe them a personal explanation before it breaks on the news."
"They'll be happy to hear their son's alive," Annie said.
"Yes, he's alive," Teddy said. "But if my math is right, he's doomed to starve to death before we can possibly help him. I'm not looking forward to the conversation."
"Fuck," Annie said thoughtfully.
"Nothing. Nothing at all," Venkat groaned. "Are you kidding me? You had 20 experts working for 12 hours on this. We have a multi-billion-dollar communications network. You can't figure out any way to talk to him?"
The two men in Venkat's office fidgeted in their chairs.
"He's got no radio," said Chuck.
"Well, actually," said Morris, "he's got a radio, but he doesn't have a dish."
"Thing is," Chuck continued, "without the dish, a signal would have to be really strong."
"Like melting the pigeon strong," Morris supplied.
"For him to get it," Chuck finished.
"We considered Martian satellites," Morris said. "They're way closer, but the math doesn't work out. Even Super Surveyor 3, which has the strongest transmitter, would need to be 14 times more powerful."
17 times, Chuck said.
14 times, Morris asserted.
"No, it's 17. You forgot the amperage minimum for the heaters to keep the..."
"Guys," Venkat interrupted.
"I get the idea."
"Sorry."
"Sorry. Sorry if I'm grumpy," Venkat said. "I got like 2 hours sleep last night."
"No problem," Morris said. "Totally understandable," Chuck said.
"Okay," Venkat said. "Explain to me how a single windstorm removed our ability to talk to Ares III.
"Failure of imagination," Chuck said.
"Totally didn't see it coming," Morris agreed.
"How many backup communication systems does an Ares mission have?" Venkat asked.
4, Chuck said.
3,
Morris said.
"No, it's 4, Chuck corrected.
"He said backup systems," Morris insisted. "That means not including the primary system."
"Oh, right, 3.
So four systems total, then, Venkat said. Explain how we lost all four.
Well, Chuck said, the primary ran through the big satellite dish. It blew away in the storm. The rest of the backups were in the MAV.
Yup, Morris agreed. The MAV is like a communicating machine. It can talk to Earth, Hermes, even satellites around Mars if it has to. And it has three independent systems to make sure nothing short of a meteor strike can stop communication.
Problem is, Chuck said, Commander Lewis and the rest of them took the MAV when they left.
So four independent communication systems became one. And that one broke, Morris finished.
Venkat pinched the bridge of his nose.
How could we overlook this?
Chuck shrugged.
Never occurred to us. We never thought someone would be on Mars without an MAV.
I mean, come on, Morris said. What are the odds?
Chuck turned to him.
1 in 3, based on empirical data. That's pretty bad if you think about it.
This was going to be rough, and Annie knew it. Not only did she have to deliver the biggest mea culpa in NASA's history, every second of it would be remembered forever. Every movement of her arms, intonation of her voice, and expression on her face would be seen by millions of people over and over again. Not just in the immediate press cycle, but for decades to come. Every documentary made about Watney's situation would have this clip. She was confident that none of that concern showed on her face as she took to the podium.
Thank you all for coming on such short notice, she said to the assembled reporters. We have an important announcement to make. If you could all take your seats.
What's this about, Annie?
Brian Hess from NBC asked.
Something happened with Hermes?
Please take your seats, Annie repeated.
The reporters milled about and argued over seats for a brief time, then finally settled down.
This is a short but very important announcement, Annie said. I won't be taking any questions at this time, but we will have a full press conference with Q&A in about an hour. We have recently reviewed satellite imagery from Mars and have confirmed that astronaut Mark Watney is currently still alive. After one full second of utter silence, the room exploded with noise. A week after the stunning announcement, it was still the top story on every news network in the world.
I'm getting sick of daily press conferences, Venkat whispered to Annie.
I'm getting sick of hourly press conferences, Annie whispered back.
The two stood with countless other NASA managers and executives bunched up on the small stage in the press room. They faced a pit of hungry reporters, all desperate for any scrap of new information.
Sorry I'm late, Teddy said, entering from the side door.
He pulled some flashcards from his pocket, squared them in his hands, then cleared his throat.
In the 9 days since announcing Mark Watney's survival, we've received a massive show of support from all sectors. We're using this shamelessly, every way we can.
A small chuckle cascaded through the room.
Yesterday, at our request, the entire SETI network focused on Mars, just in case Watney was sending a weak radio signal. Turns out he wasn't, but it shows the level of commitment everyone has toward helping us. The public is engaged, and we will do our best to keep everyone informed. I've recently learned CNN will be dedicating a half-hour segment every weekday to reporting on just this issue. We will assign several members of our media relations team to that program, so the public can get the latest information as fast as possible. We have adjusted the orbits of 3 satellites to get more view time on the Ares 3 site and hope to catch an image of Mark outside soon. If we can see him outside, we will be able to draw conclusions on his physical health based on stance and activities. The questions are many. How long can he last? How much food does he have? Can Ares 4 rescue him? How will we talk to him? The answers to these questions are not what we want to hear. I can't promise we'll succeed in rescuing him, but I can promise this. The entire focus of NASA will be to bring Mark Watney home. This will be our overriding and singular obsession until he is either back on Earth or confirmed dead on Mars.
Nice speech, Venkat said as he entered Teddy's office.
Meant every word of it, Teddy said.
Oh, I know.
What can I do for you, Venk?
I've got an idea. Well, JPL has an idea. I'm the messenger.
I like ideas, Teddy said, gesturing to a seat.
Venkat sat down.
We can rescue him with Ares IV. It's very risky. We ran the idea by the Ares IV crew. Not only are they willing to do it, but now they're really pushing hard for it.
Naturally, Teddy said. Astronauts are inherently insane. And really noble. What's the idea?
Well, Venkat began. It's in the rough stages, but JPL thinks the MDV can be misused to save him.
Ares IV hasn't even launched yet. Why misuse an MDV? Why not make something better?
We don't have time to make a custom craft. Actually, he can't even survive till Ares IV gets there, but that's a different problem.
So tell me about the MDV.
JPL strips it down, loses some weight, and adds some fuel tanks. Ares IV's crew lands at the Ares III site very efficiently. Then, with a full burn, and I mean a full burn, they can lift off again. It can't get back to orbit, but it can go to the Ares IV site on a lateral trajectory that's, well, really scary. Then they have an MAV.
How are they losing weight? Teddy asked. Don't they already have it as light as it can be?
By removing safety and emergency equipment.
Wonderful, Teddy said. So we'd be risking the lives of 6 more people.
Yep, Venkat said. It would be safer to leave the Ares IV crew in Hermes and only send the pilot down with the MDV, but that would mean giving up the mission, and they'd rather risk death.
They're astronauts, Teddy said.
They're astronauts, Venkat confirmed.
Well, that's a ludicrous idea, and I'll never okay it.
We'll work on it some more, Venkat said. Try to make it safer.
Do that. Any idea how to keep him alive for 4 years?
Nope.
Work on that, too.
Will do, Venkat said.
Teddy swiveled his chair and looked out the window to the sky beyond. Night was edging in.
What must it be like? He pondered. He's stuck out there. He thinks he's totally alone and that we all gave up on him. What kind of effect does that have on a man's psychology?
He turned back to Venkat.
I wonder what he's thinking right now.
Log entry. Sol 61.
How come Aquaman can control whales? They're mammals. Makes no sense.
Chapter 7. Log entry. Sol 63. I finished making water some time ago. I'm no longer in danger of blowing myself up. The potatoes are growing nicely. Nothing has conspired to kill me in weeks, and 70s TV keeps me disturbingly more entertained than it should. Things are stable here on Mars. It's time to start thinking long-term. Even if I find a way to tell NASA I'm alive, there's no guarantee they'll be able to save me. I need to be proactive. I need to figure out how to get to Ares IV. Won't be easy. Ares IV will be landing at the Schiaparelli crater, 3,200 kilometers away. In fact, their MAV is already there. I know because I watched Martinez land it. It takes 18 months for the MAV to make its fuel, so it's the first thing NASA sends along. Sending it 48 months early gives it plenty of extra time in case fuel reactions go slower than expected. But much more importantly, it means a precision soft landing can be done remotely by a pilot in orbit. Direct remote operation from Houston isn't an option. They're anywhere from 4 to 20 light minutes away. Ares IV's MAV spent 11 months getting to Mars. It left before us and got here around the same time we did. As expected, Martinez landed it beautifully. It was one of the last things we did before piling into our MDV and heading to the surface. Ah, the good old days when I had a crew with me. I'm lucky. 3,200 kilometers isn't that bad. It could have been up to 10,000 kilometers away, and because I'm on the flattest part of Mars, the first 650 kilometers is nice, smooth terrain, yaya Sedalia Planitia, but the rest of it is nasty, rugged, crater-pocked hell. Obviously, I'll have to use a rover. And guess what? They weren't designed for massive overland journeys. This is going to be a research effort with a bunch of experimentation. I'll have to become my own little NASA, figuring out how to explore far from the hab. The good news is I have lots of time to figure it out. Almost 4 years.
Some stuff is obvious. I'll need to use a rover. It'll take a long time, so I'll need to bring supplies. I'll need to recharge en route, and rovers don't have solar cells, so I'll need to steal some from the Habs solar farm. During the trip, I'll need to breathe, eat, and drink. Lucky for me, the tech specs for everything are right here in the computer. I'll need to trick out a rover. Basically, it'll have to be a mobile Hab. I'll pick Rover 2 as my target. We have a certain bond after I spent 2 days in it during the Great Hydrogen Scare of Sol 37. There's too much shit to think about all at once, so for now, I'll just think about power. Our mission had a 10-kilometer operational radius. Knowing we wouldn't take straight-line paths, NASA designed the rovers to go 35 kilometers on a full charge. That presumes flat, reasonable terrain. Each rover has a 9,000-watt-hour battery. Step one is to loot Rover 1's battery and install it in Rover 2. Ta-da! I just doubled my full charge range. There's just one complication. Heating. Part of the battery power goes to heating the rover. Mars is really cold. Normally, we were expected to do all EVAs in under 5 hours, but I'll be living in it 24 and a half hours a day. According to the specs, the heating equipment soaks up 400 watts. Keeping it on would eat up 9,800 watt-hours per day, over half my power supply every day. But I do have a free source of heat. Me. A couple million years of evolution gave me warm-blooded technology. I can just turn off the heater and wear layers. The rover has good insulation, too. It'll have to be enough. I need every bit of power. According to my boring math, moving the rover eats 200 watt-hours of juice to go 1 kilometer. So using the full 18,000 watt-hours for motion, minus a negligible amount for computer, life support, etc., gets me 90 kilometers of travel. Now we're talking. I'll never actually get 90 kilometers on a single charge. I'll have hills to deal with and rough terrain, sand, etc., but it's a good ballpark. It tells me that it would take at least 35 days of travel to get to Ares 4. It'll probably be more like 50, but that's plausible at least. At the rover's blazing 25 kilometers per hour top speed, it'll take me 3.5 hours before I run the battery down. I can drive in twilight and save the sunny part of the day for charging. This time of year I get about 13 hours of light. How many solar cells will I have to pilfer from the Habs farm? Thanks to the fine taxpayers of America, I have over 100 square meters of the most expensive solar paneling ever made. It has an astounding 10.2% efficiency, which is good, because Mars doesn't get as much sunlight as Earth, only 500 to 700 watts per square meter, compared to the 1,400 Earth gets. Long story short, I need to bring 28 square meters of solar cell. That's 14 panels. I can put 2 stacks of 7 on the roof. They'll stick out over the edges, but as long as they're secure, I'm happy. Every day after driving, I'll spread them out, then wait all day. Man, it'll be dull. Well, it's a start. Tomorrow's mission. Transfer Rover 1's battery to Rover 2. Log entry. Sol 64. Sometimes things are easy, and sometimes they're not. Getting the battery out of Rover 1 was easy. I removed 2 clamps on the undercarriage and it dropped right out. The cabling was easy to detach too, just a couple of complicated plugs. Attaching it to Rover 2, however, is another story. There's nowhere to put it. The thing is huge. I was barely able to drag it, and that's in Mars gravity. It's just too big. There's no room in the undercarriage for a second one. There's no room on the roof either. That's where the solar cells will go. There's no room inside the cabin, and it wouldn't fit through the airlock anyway. But fear not, I found a solution. For emergencies completely unrelated to this one, NASA provided 6 square meters of extra Hab canvas and some really impressive resin. The same kind of resin, in fact, that saved my life on Sol 6, the patch kit I used on the hole in my suit. In the event of a Hab breach, everyone would run to the airlocks. Procedure was to let the Hab pop, rather than die trying to prevent it. Then we'd suit up and assess the damage. Once we found the breach, we'd seal it with the spare canvas and resin, then reinflate, and we're good as new. The 6 square meters of spare canvas was a convenient 1 by 6 meters. I cut 10-centimeter-wide strips, then used them to make a sort of harness. I used the resin and straps to make 2 10-meter circumference loops. Then I put a big patch of canvas on each end. I now had poor man's saddlebags for my